Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is the executive director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
It works. Cooperation works. I think it's the most undervalued thing in American enterprise is the incredible power in building human trust and cooperation.
Bob Atwell's critical career decisions can best be summed up by one word, contrarian.
Unlike most of his classmates at Yale School of Management, Bob came back to the Midwest to find work. Secure in a sought-after commercial lending job at a big Milwaukee financial institution, Bob decided he'd rather be in a small town at a smaller bank. At that smaller bank, in a smaller town, Bob found a stable job with a great deal of responsibility. Then, despite having 10 kids, with an 11th on the way, Bob quit.
He and a colleague raised $18 million and started Nicolet National Bank in 2000, the biggest bank startup in state history at that time. Nicolet today has $3 billion in assets, 38 branches, and a lead local position in many of its markets.
Nicolet is now the third largest bank in Wisconsin. Bob, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Bob, when you were an undergraduate at Beloit College, you spent some time in Germany. Tell us about how that experience shaped your ambition.
Yeah. After my first three semesters at Beloit, I don't think they'd invented gap years yet, but I decided to take one and headed over to Germany. I was very fortunate to get a job as a marketing intern working for an American company. And so I worked 8 months. And in those days, you know, transatlantic phone calls were very expensive. So I had one phone call in 11 months in total in Germany. So studied a semester, worked 8 months, and really changed my life. It was an awesome experience.
And how did it change your life?
Well, let's see. Probably the first three semesters at Beloit, my focus on academics had perhaps been not exactly what it should have been. And getting out of that environment and finding myself in a totally new culture where I really had to learn to master the language and understand the people gave me just a great opportunity to think about my life and just learn. It was amazing.
You had many opportunities to test your independence and maybe your ambition. After Beloit, you got a job in Washington, D.C. at the Department of Labor. Then you went to Yale School of Management. Why didn't you stay on the East Coast?
When I went out there, I really thought I was going to stay out there. I think I kind of had the idea I wanted to work in, do something really important and work for the government. And I think a lot of people do good things at the government. I found it at the Department of Labor, kind of figured out that wasn't my track. And the Yale experience was also very formative, but I think I really encountered the depth, I guess, of ignorance on the coasts about what life in the Midwest is like. And I had this experience of falling in love with my home from afar and really started to build my plans for my life and my family and my career around a place.
You said ignorance, maybe a little arrogance?
There was actually sort of a profound antipathy, actually. There was a real sense that they did understand what the Midwest was about, and it was a very ugly picture they had, and it didn't conform at all to my experience growing up.
So you came back to Milwaukee after all of that, and you took a job at First Wisconsin, which is now First Star, but then you left that to go to Associated. Now, why is that?
I've always had a little restlessness, I guess, Tim, but it was a great experience in Milwaukee, but I was really more interested in a smaller community and wanted to be in more of a connected economic environment. I had a great job in Milwaukee, but I was traveling around the state dealing with the larger companies and in the outstate areas, and I'd go home at night, or I'd go home the next day, and I didn't really live with the people. I wasn't really part of the life of the people that I interacted with from a business point of view.
So you found Nirvana. You got a high-level job at Associated Bank, and Nirvana didn't last forever. You eventually became the person who signed off on all their large loans. Why didn't that work? You were in a community. You were dealing with people in the community.
Well, let's be fair. I was there 13 years, so it wasn't exactly a happy feat. But we had a great experience growing the bank. It was a $500 million bank in Green Bay when I went there. I think the holding company was $1.2 billion. By the time I left, it was $13 billion, and it had gotten kind of big. And it had like I think a lot of businesses, sort of, in my view, started to lose its sense of purpose and get disconnected from its history. That was certainly my perspective. I stayed two or three more years to try to, lead from within, and eventually realized, hey, nobody died and put me in charge of this organization, and if I have a different vision of where things should go, I should either shut up and get with the program or go do something else more in accordance with what I saw.
So you had 10 going on 11 kids. Your sidekick, another executive there, Mike Daniels, had 7 kids. And Mike talked you into leaving these great jobs you both had?
Yeah, Mike was and still is sort of more of a natural entrepreneur than I am. Very, very comfortable just getting out there and making things happen. He's been an awesome partner for me. But yeah, it took a little coaxing. I was more senior. I had more security to walk away from, higher compensation. But ultimately, I realized it wasn't very safe to sit in a situation where you're being paid to really put your heart into an organization that you don't feel comfortable about the direction, or at least my fit with the direction they were going. So I didn't feel that was very safe either. So
what makes a good bank?
Oh, I think what makes any good business or organization is a focus on service, focus on the human person, a strong sense of purpose that, look, if you ask American business students, and you've been around business people a lot, ask them what the purpose of an organization is, a private organization or a public one, and they're going to tell you the purpose is to make money. I can't disagree more. The purpose is to serve and to serve your customers well. The result is the financial return to the shareholders. And I think it's very common for organizations to get confused about that. There's a fair amount of pressure in the legal regulatory environment to assert that my focus should always be on the bottom line or on the shareholders. We've been very explicit that we don't agree with that. We think the focus is on the customer and the result is the result.
So you started Nicolet in 2000, but you started it as a no brick and mortar bank, which means really commercial lending. And when did you add retail to that?
Well, we actually started doing retail right away, but Mike and I were both commercial lenders by background, so we saw the world through those eyes. We thought that's what the bank was because that was our professional background. Over time, I think we came to understand that not only do our customers need retail, but if you really want to have a sound, enduring community bank, you need to have a strong retail presence, commercial, and wealth management as well. So we broadened our vision just from learning and growing and having some nudges along the way to get us to see it differently.
So, Bob, there was a pretty big moment when you decided to do retail. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we were already doing retail, but we were commercial guys. We'd grown tremendously. The bank had brought in quite a bit of commercial business, and we were funding it using wholesale funds. Something that if you're in banking, the regulators are not a big fan of banks using extensive wholesale funds. That is going out and buying the funding we need on the open market. Their view, and I think it's correct, is it's not the optimal or stable way to fund an organization. So we were a national bank. We are a national bank. And there was an old school bank regulator, Al Kovarik. And I think the statute of limitations has kind of run out on the story here. But back in 2003, three or four, we had grown tremendously. He called me up one day, and Al was actually he was an interrogator in Vietnam. So he called me up one morning. He says, Bob, I'd like to get together with you. Well, yes, Mr. Kovarik. You thinking next week? You want to give me a couple days? I'm on my way there right now. Okay, well, I'll get Mike, and we'll... No, actually, I'd just like to meet with you. And he came into my office, and he sat down with me, and he said... The gist of it was, hey, Bob, get a clue. You're not going to run a bank this way. You need to have an organically funded institution, and you need to, if you're going to be a sound bank for the long term, the path you're on right now isn't the one you should be on. And I love to tell that story because we have great, great respect for the work the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is our principal regulator, the people that we've interacted with over the years have been just straightforward, really knowledgeable, and very direct when they need to be, and in general, just very, very helpful. And Al retired probably 10, 12 years ago, and he ran the Iron Mountain office, so he lives up in the Upper Peninsula, but great guy, did his job extremely well, and was actually a great help to us.
So how do you guys do during 2007 and 8 when most of the banks in the world had a lot of problems?
Well, I don't want to claim too much credit. We had grown very rapidly, and we had decided to grow our profitability and round out the retail side of the bank and kind of become more of a full bank. And in the environment we were in, it felt funny. When you actually have to raise capital and raise deposits and grow a bank, and you look at the competitive environment and it just doesn't make sense. We were able to look at each other and say, you know what, we'll accept a lower growth rate. So this is 2005, 6, 7, when the real problems were sowed. We didn't hit budget. We explained to the board we're not going to hit budget for growth. We were still making money, but we kind of had that queasy feeling. And then we had very seasoned bond guy, Mike Stepp. He's still with us. Mike was studying the environment, and he was kind of in my ear saying, Bob, this is not good. This is not good. So we were well kind of prepared from having slowed the growth of the bank. And then when the real problems happened, we got after it very quickly. And it served us very, very well to anticipate a little bit and then react very quickly. So we actually never lost. We took loan losses, but the bank in total never lost money, and we continued to grow. We actually grew 7% organically during the darker days, and I'm very proud of how we worked with a lot of our customers, and very proud of them for having done what they needed to do to deal with the environment.
So since 2010, you've made 5 acquisitions, and so our listeners are interested in kind of how businesses grow and where the exits ultimately become. Why don't you tell us about these acquisitions?
So when we had worked through our customers' challenges early in the financial crisis, pretty quickly we realized we had strong capital. We were in much better shape than most of the community institutions around us. We had a healthy relationship with our regulator. We started looking for opportunities to really, you know, benefit, frankly, from the carnage in the crisis. And so we looked at a lot of banks that were on the brink of failing. Ultimately, we only bought one of the FDIC failed banks, a small one in Wausau. But that gave rise after a couple years to some real opportunities from a bank over in Medford that was a small cap publicly traded company and was looking to exit. They had really suffered in the crisis. They'd seen their stock go down from 30 to $6 or four bucks even, I think. And they weren't going to die, but they were not getting out of the position they were in. So we came to terms to buy that bank. And because they were small cap public, we were a private company, we agreed to assume SEC filing status. At that time, we didn't go on NASDAQ, but we became an SEC publicly regulated company really by default through that transaction because we needed to support the liquidity of their shareholders. And really, you couldn't, when you reach a certain number of shareholders, how do you trade the stock over the president's desk effectively? You need a way for buyers and sellers to get together without me in between. So we've actually never done. We did a subsequently followed up with the Bay Lake merger, and we became more actively traded, went on NASDAQ. But the interesting thing about our company, we're a $550 million-ish market cap company, and we've never actually done a public stock issue through our public status. So the investment community has a hard time understanding us because we've never gone out to them and said, hey, can you please give us $25, $50 million in what would be called an IPO. We've always raised our stock through direct sales to people that we knew, or through buying a bank whose shareholders assumed status as our shareholders. So we're a fairly large company to be that sort of localish, but 80% of our shareholders we estimate are really local Wisconsin people who live in the communities we serve and chose to invest in us through the sale of their bank or because we sold them stock directly.
And they've done well by you. Just one more question, Bob. Everyone knows the movie It's a Wonderful Life and kind of the contrast between the community-oriented bank and the other bank. You're a big believer in community and in the bank being a part of the community. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we are essentially, I tell people in a way, we're kind of a for-profit co-op, or we're a credit union that pays taxes and your ownership is voluntary. Almost all the resources we deal with, our ownership's local, our deposits are local, and our lending is overwhelmingly local. So we see ourselves as a vessel of community cooperation. That's been the understanding really from the beginning, and it's what we've sought to live. We don't do it perfectly every day, but we're really clear. Back to the purpose of the organization, I get to tell our shareholders at pretty much every annual meeting, if you think the purpose of our organization is to make you money, you might want to own a different stock. We're not saying we're not going to earn a return for you. We're going to say the purpose is the role we play in helping the community live better and better fulfill the financial aspirations of the people who live and work there. And it works. Cooperation works. I think it's the most undervalued thing in American enterprise is the incredible power in building human trust and cooperation.
That said, it seems like that attitude does lead toward your shareholders doing well.
Our shareholders have done very well, but they've done it because we stay focused on what we should stay focused on. You know, our initial shareholders, we bought the stock at $10. We're 55, 56, 57 today. So it's been quite a ride, but it's been a good one. The result, you know, when I talk about purpose, I don't mean I don't care about the result. I mean focus on the purpose and let the result.
Thanks so much for joining us, Bob. It was great having you.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
You can read more about this story and find links to resources by visiting WUWM.com.
And listen to all our podcasts at WUWM at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.